A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 6, Aristotle's Ethics.
Aristotle is probably the most popular philosopher in the world. This statement will sound surprising to most people because most people have not read Aristotle. His books are rather dull. They're summaries of his university lectures, a striking contrast to Plato, who wrote dramatic dialogues with great psychological power and poetic beauty of language, and who always makes things interesting because he uses the character of Socrates, one of the most interesting men who ever lived. Yet the content of Aristotle's philosophy is much more popular than Plato's because it's so commonsensical in every field. Aristotle studied under Plato for half his life and inherited many of his main ideas from him, but he modified most of them in some way. For instance, let's look briefly at the difference between Plato and Aristotle in metaphysics, in anthropology, in epistemology, and in ethics, and I think we will see a common pattern. In metaphysics, Plato and Aristotle agreed that reality was full of intelligible forms or essences or natures, and that the philosopher needed to know them and define them. But Plato believed that these essences existed in a separate dimension from everything else because they were changeless and everything else was changing. But Aristotle said they were just the essences of changing things. For instance, Plato said you would find justice in itself apart from just actions or just people or just states, and that people and states participated in or shared or reflected a little bit of this perfect essence in an imperfect way, like little mirrors reflecting the light of the sun. They were in a different realm of reality than the things in space and time. But Aristotle rejected Plato's two worlds theory and said the forms or essences or ideas existed only in changing things and in the minds of those who know them. We find the same difference in anthropology. Plato sharply separated the body and the soul, or the mind, while Aristotle said the soul is the form of the body, and the body is the matter or content for the soul, rather like the relationship between the meaning and the words of a book. Plato's separation of body and soul made it easy for him to account for the immortality of the soul after the death of the body. Aristotle's close union of the body and soul as form and matter of the same substance, the same individual, made it easier for Aristotle to account for our sense of psychosomatic unity. We don't feel like a ghost in a machine, to use the phrase of a modern British philosopher Gilbert Ryle, which was popularized as the title of an album by the rock group The Police back in the 70s, I think. Plato didn't use that image, the ghost in the machine, but he did call the body the prison house of the soul. And we find the same difference in epistemology. Because Plato separated form and matter, he separated soul and body. And because he separated soul and body, he separated reason, the soul's tool for knowing, from sense experience, the body's tool for knowing. He believed that we all had an innate knowledge of the Platonic ideas in our minds, and that philosophizing was calling up these ideas by a process he called recollection, rather like psychoanalysis calling up unconscious knowledge into the conscious mind. Aristotle, on the other hand, taught that all knowledge begins with sense experience, and that we abstracted these forms or essences from sense experience because that's where they are, according to Aristotle's metaphysics, in concrete things. You find justice in just men, so you must begin with the experience of men and life to know justice. And that accounts for the difference in ethics, both in method and in content. In method, Plato is always looking for a perfect definition, while Aristotle is always looking to real life. And in content, Plato taught that the good life was simply the virtuous life, and that bodily goods simply didn't matter, while Aristotle said they did, though not as much as the soul. So Aristotle would not agree with Socrates' statement that no evil could happen to a good man, ever, in this life or the next, because a man was simply his soul. Aristotle was not an ethical relativist or an ethical subjectivist, but you could call him an ethical realist. Now, let's begin our exploration of this great book, The Nicomachean Ethics, really the first systematic philosophical ethics in the history of the world, with the question the book focuses on. What is the good? What is the good man and the good life? The question of the good man is the question of virtues, good habits of acting. Neither Plato nor Aristotle were legalists with lists of rules. Ethics was more a matter of character than rules. It was an ethics that centered on virtues. Aristotle accepted Plato's scheme of the four cardinal virtues and added about eight more minor virtues to them. I'll mention some of them in a moment. But the other question is really the central one. What is the good life? What is the end or purpose of life? What is the greatest good, the end of ends? This comes up at the beginning of the Nicomachean Ethics, and we'll concentrate on the beginning, on Book 1, because that's where Aristotle gives you his answer to this most important question of all, and then the other nine books flow from that as consequences or details. We'll have our noses in this book pretty closely, and I hope it will feel less like dull scholarship than like getting to know a friend by a lot of listening. Aristotle begins by defining the word good, the single most basic word in ethics. And he does it by looking at how people use the word, what things they call good, and what is common to all those things. And here is what he finds. Here is the very first sentence of the book. Aristotle writes, "Every art and every inquiry, and also every action and every pursuit, is thought to aim at some good. And for this reason, the good has rightly been declared to be that at which all things aim." So, the good is the object of aim, that is, purposive human activity, whether mental or physical, activity motivated by some desire. The good is always what we desire, whether this is the moral good or some other kind of good, and whether it's really good or only apparently good. Aristotle does not identify the real good and the apparent good. He doesn't identify the desirable with the desired. He assumes that some things that we desire, like good food, really are good for us, and other things that we desire, like unhealthy food, are not. So he doesn't define goodness in a relative way. He does not think that good is whatever we desire, that our desiring it is what makes it good. Just the opposite. It's being good, or at least appearing good to us, is what makes us desire it. Desire is to good what belief is to truth. Next, he notes that desire has a structure. There are some things that we desire only for the sake of other things, like money, or tools, or medicine. And there are things that we desire for their own sakes, like pleasure, and beauty, and truth. This is the distinction between what we call means and ends. And that helps to narrow our investigation because we are looking for the good as the end, and even more specifically, the final end, the end of ends, the answer to the question, what good is all of it? What good is human life? What's it all for? Perhaps human life doesn't have a purpose. Even in Aristotle's day, there were some thinkers, notably the Sophists, who thought that the question of the meaning of life was not meaningful because there was no final end, no final purpose. There were just means. So Aristotle refutes that view before he goes any further, and he proves that there is something there to try to find. There's got to be some final end. If he can't prove that, then the whole attempt to find it will come to nothing, like the search for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The argument he uses is very simple. He writes, "If we choose everything for the sake of something else, that process would go on to infinity so that our desire would be empty and vain." In other words, just as the principle of cause and effect dictates that a row of dominoes has to have some first domino fall down in order to have the whole row of dominoes fall, the effect depends on the cause, So human desire works by the same principle of cause and effect in the opposite direction, so to speak. There has to be a last end, a thing worth desiring for its own sake, in order to motivate us to desire all the means to that end. We wouldn't want car keys if we didn't want to use them to drive the car, and we wouldn't want a car if we wouldn't want to use it to go places, and we wouldn't want to go places if those places weren't desirable, and so forth. But if nothing is good or desirable in itself, if nothing is worth having just for the sake of having it, then nothing would be good or desirable at all. Life would be a merry-go-round that went nowhere. So there must be some end, some purpose, some goal, some good, something desirable that motivates us as final, at least unconsciously, motivates us to do everything we do. That's what we're seeking when we ask, what is the meaning of life? What is the summum bonum? Aristotle points out that this question is an utterly practical question. He writes, "Will not the knowledge of it, then, have a great influence on life? Shall we not, like archers who have a mark to aim at, be more likely to hit upon what is right?" It is a practical question, but it is not an easy one. And Aristotle admits that we cannot hope to have as much clarity, as much light on this subject as we would like. In some subjects, there is a right answer, and there is objective truth, and it can be found and defined clearly. Mathematics and the physical sciences, for instance. Ethics is not like that. At the opposite extreme, in some other subjects, there is no objective truth. Matters of taste, of fashion, of human convention, the arts, for instance. Now, it may look like ethics belongs in that class, and Aristotle admits that just actions exhibit much variety and fluctuation so that they may be thought to exist only by human convention and not by nature. That's what the Sophists believed, and what many modern ethical philosophers believe too. But Aristotle disagrees with that. Like Socrates, he takes the middle position, that there is a universally true and objectively true good, but it is not easy to find. He writes, "It is the mark of an educated man to look for as much clarity in each kind of things as the nature of the subject permits. It is evidently equally foolish to accept only probable reasonings from a mathematician or to demand demonstrative proofs from a rhetorician." He thinks ethics is neither math nor rhetoric, but between the two. It's not clear and non-controversial like math, nor is it man-made and artificial like rhetoric. The question of the greatest good is hard to answer in real content, but it's quite easy to answer in words. Aristotle writes, "Verbally, there is very general agreement that it is happiness. But with regard to what happiness is, people differ. It is happiness," Aristotle argues, "because everyone seeks it. No one wants to be unhappy. And everyone seeks it as an end and not as a means. No one says, what good is happiness? It can't buy money. But some people say, what good is money? It can't buy happiness. And other people don't say that. So people differ about the means, but everyone wants the same end, happiness." But the two Greek words Aristotle uses for happiness both mean something more than just subjective contentment. One of them, makarios, means blessedness or supreme blessedness. It's essentially a stronger form of the first word, eudaimonia, which is the word Aristotle usually uses. I think it's misleading to translate eudaimonia as happiness, because the word happiness comes from the same root as the word happen. It comes from the Old English word hap, which means luck or chance. If you see a big smile on your friend's face today, what's the first thing you say? What happened to you? Did you just win the lottery? We think of happiness as something that happens by good luck. It has nothing to do with how good you are. It happens by chance, and it's temporary. But eudaimonia means something different in all three ways. It has everything to do with how good you are, and it happens not by chance, but by choice, and it's lasting. It has three parts. The first syllable, you, means good, and the middle part, daimon, means spirit or soul, and the last syllable, ia, which makes it into a noun, means some objectively real and lasting state or nature. So eudaimonia means the objectively real lasting state of really having a good soul. It contains three connotations that the English word happiness does not. First, you have to be good to be happy. And second, it's in the soul more than the body, not in external goods of fortune, good luck. And third, and most important of all, it's an objectively real state or nature, so you can be mistaken about it. In English, it makes no sense to say to somebody, you think you're happy, but you're not. Or, you think you're not happy, but you really are. But in Greek, it does make sense. One clear test of that difference is suffering. Could suffering possibly be part of happiness? Not in modern English, but in ancient Greek, yes. Aristotle would say, and so would Aeschylus and Sophocles and Socrates and Plato, that you can't be truly happy unless you are wise, and you can't be truly wise unless you suffer. As Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel put it, the man who has not suffered, what could he possibly know anyway? I think the English word blessedness comes closer to what Aristotle means by eudaimonia. You can think you're blessed, but be wrong. If you've just inherited a castle that's going to wipe you out in taxes, for instance. And you can think you're not blessed when you are. That's why we tell people, and we tell ourselves, to count your blessings, implying that we're really blessed, but we don't realize it until these blessings that we take for granted disappear. So, we're now looking for blessedness, true objective happiness, the true good, not just subjective contentment. If Aristotle found somebody who was perfectly content making mud pies, he would not call that person happy. And I think he would classify many of the things that make us happy as fancy mud pies. So, what is the content of happiness, if not mud pies? We are looking for the good. We have identified the good with the final end. And we have identified the final end with happiness. So, what do we identify happiness with? What makes us truly happy? This question has a hidden assumption, that happiness is essentially the same for everyone, because it is the fulfillment of our deepest desire, which comes from our essential nature, which is the same in everyone. That's an assumption that's not very popular today, but I don't know why. Do we think happiness is not the fulfillment of our deepest desire? Or do we think that our deepest desire does not come from our very essence, our essential humanity? Or do we think that we are not all equally human? Do we deny essential human equality? Different strokes for different folks can only go so far. I may like ice cream and you may like yogurt. I may like the Red Sox and you may like the Yankees, but we both like pleasure and health and freedom and beauty and knowledge and friendship. Everyone does. Aristotle mentions different candidates for the exalted position of happiness. He begins with three that come from his observation of different lifestyles, as we would say today. Most men love pleasure, a few love honor, and a very few love what Aristotle will eventually label as the most godlike thing in life, contemplation, or the knowledge of essential eternal truth for its own sake. I think he has in mind mystical experience here. The only thing wrong with that as the answer to what is supreme human happiness is that Aristotle thinks that only a few people are capable of it, and only for short periods of time. I wonder whether here he contradicts his essential human equality principle. He says pleasure can't be the highest good because it's not distinctively human. It's common to both men and animals. And wealth can't be the ultimate good because money is good only as a means of exchange. We want it for the sake of other things, but now we're looking for the end. Aristotle also mentions, as a candidate, Plato's idea of the good, but he rejects it because it's too abstract and indefinite. It's not concrete. It's a generic term. He also says honor can't be the highest good, even though many people seek it, because, he writes, it is thought to depend on those who bestow honor rather than on him who receives it, whereas the good is one's own possession and not easily taken away. Also, men pursue honor not for its own sake, but in order to be assured of their merit, for it is by men of practical wisdom that they seek to be honored, not by fools, and by those who know them, and on the grounds of their virtue. Well, perhaps it's virtue, then. Is that identical with happiness? Aristotle will include that as part of his definition of happiness, but not as the whole of it, because it is compatible with great suffering. He gives the example of King Priam of Troy, a virtuous man who suffered every possible misfortune, rather like Job. Even though Aristotle thinks human happiness is not mainly or exclusively material and external, yet man is a body as well as a soul, so bodily goods must count. They must be part of happiness. You don't need a lot of material goods to be happy, but you need some. And you can be happy even though you suffer, but not if you suffer enormously. Aristotle takes a middle-of-the-road position here, as he habitually does, between the materialist and the spiritualist, like Plato, who tried to prove in the Republic that justice alone was enough to make you happy, even if you had no material goods, like Socrates. We still don't have a complete definition of happiness. So Aristotle gives us a better way to find it than by looking at popular answers, and that's by looking at human nature, and at the natural end or purpose or function of man. He argues that every occupation or work of man has a function. Carpenters, soldiers, farmers. So mustn't there be a natural end of human life as a whole? All these occupations are like parts of the machine of human life. How could each of the parts of the machine have an end, but not the machine itself? Or to use another analogy, every organ in the human body has an end, a natural function. The eye, the hand, the foot, the kidney. How could man as a whole not have an end? And if we can find that end, or purpose, or function of man as a whole, we would find happiness, for happiness would be attaining that end. So, being happy, being good, and being fully human are ultimately three ways of saying the same thing. Well, what could that be? We need to be more specific. What good does happiness consist in? What makes us fully happy and fully human? Not just pleasure or life or sense experience, because that's not distinctively human. Animals have it too. What distinguishes us from animals is reason, mind, thought. Living according to reason, then, is the human good. And that includes both intellectual virtues like wisdom and knowledge, and also moral virtues like the four cardinal virtues. Happiness is in the rational soul, not in the body, because that's what's distinctively human. So here's Aristotle's definition of happiness, or the good for man, an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. But he has to add, in a complete life, with enough material goods. For, he writes, there are some things the lack of which take the luster out of happiness, good birth, good children, beauty. For the man who is very ugly, or ill-born, or solitary, or childless, or has bad children, is not likely to be completely happy. I wonder if he is thinking of Socrates here. Socrates was ugly, and born poor, and not understood, and had bad children. How could Aristotle explain why Socrates was happy? In the last chapter of Book 1, Chapter 10, Aristotle changes his mind two or three times, in print, over whether happiness needs these goods of fortune at all. On the one hand, Aristotle writes, if activities are, as we said, what determines the character of life, then no blessed man can ever become miserable, because he will never do the acts that are hateful and mean. The man who is truly good and wise will bear all the chances of life becomingly, and always make the best of circumstances, as a good general makes the best military use of the army at his command. One thinks of Robert E. Lee. And if we were to follow his fortunes, we should often call the same man happy and again wretched, making the happy man out to be a chameleon. On the other hand, no one would call poor Priam happy, or Job, or Oedipus, at least until the end. Aristotle eventually solves his dilemma with a compromise. He writes, "Small pieces of good or bad fortune clearly do not weigh down the scales of life one way or the other, but a multitude of great events, if they turn out well, will make life more blessed, while if they turn out ill, they will crush and maim blessedness." This compromise has problems, though, and Aristotle admits it. You can't control good luck, and if luck plays some part in happiness, then you can't be sure your life won't be like Job's or Priam's, no matter how good you are. So Aristotle considers the saying, "Call no man happy until he's dead. Wait to see the end." And he vacillates between agreeing with that saying and disagreeing with it. Like common sense itself, I think Aristotle just can't make up his mind how important the material goods of fortune are. On the one hand, the materialist is certainly wrong. The suicide rate, a pretty spectacular index of unhappiness, does have a definite relationship to wealth. Very poor individuals and nations have very low suicide rates. So material things don't make you happy. But on the other hand, the Platonic idealist who discounts the body altogether is wrong too. The body is not our motel room or our prison house. It's part of our being, our nature. So good or bad can happen to us without our control because of our body. Aristotle would not wholly agree with Socrates that the self is just the soul, and therefore no evil can ever happen to a good man by chance. This habit of finding a middle position between two extremes is probably Aristotle's most famous feature, the principle of the golden mean between two extremes. Aristotle didn't call it the golden mean, by the way, any more than Jesus called his do unto others principle the golden rule. When it came to defining each virtue, Aristotle used that principle of the mean to find each virtue between an excess or a defect. Here's how it works. Virtues, he says, are chosen by the reason and the will, which impose the right form or structure on the matter or raw material of material actions and passions or desires. So we have to steer down the middle of each road. Both sides of the road have ditches to fall into. For every virtue, there are two opposite vices. Courage is the mean between too much fear, which is cowardice, and too little fear, which is recklessness. Justice is a mean between getting or giving more and less than is deserved. Temperance or moderation is a mean between being too sensitive and being too insensitive to pleasure and pain. Modesty is a mean between shamelessness and bashfulness. Wit is a mean between boorishness and buffoonery. Friendliness is a mean between quarrelsomeness and obsequiousness or flattery. Righteous indignation is a mean between irascibility and insensitivity, too short a fuse and too slow a fuse. Pride, which Aristotle lists as a virtue, is a mean between vanity and false humility, between arrogance and worminess. By the way, when Aristotle calls pride a virtue, I think he's not talking about the same thing Christian theology is talking about when it calls pride one of the seven deadly sins. That's either competitive pride, me first put down pride, or pride over against God, my will be done, not yours. Aristotle means proper self-respect, proper self-love, which Jesus actually appealed to as a good thing in his golden rule, to love others as you love yourself. I once gave one of my students an A for a one-sentence essay on Aristotle. The assignment didn't specify any length. The title was "A Logical Critique of Aristotle's Doctrine of the Golden Mean." The sentence was, "I think this is a good idea, but Aristotle carries it to an extreme." In other words, don't we need a little extremism somewhere too? Isn't Aristotle moderate to excess? A little too controlled, too rational? What about some wildness? What about love? When Thomas Aquinas, who follows Aristotle most of the time, asks the question whether every virtue is a mean between two extremes, he says no. There are three that are not: faith, hope, and love. Aquinas adds another dimension to human life than Aristotle had, the vertical or supernatural dimension. In that dimension, there is an infinite object, a God, who is infinitely good and infinitely lovable. You can love any finite good too much, but no one can love the infinite good too much. Aristotle did believe in a God, something like the God of deism, a first mover and cause of all the order and motion in the universe, but it was not a God who was love, or who loved us, or who even knew us. Aristotle does mention a form of love in his Ethics. In fact, he spends two whole books on it, friendship. He says no life is truly blessed without friendship, and he ranks friendship as the highest form of love. In fact, his only answer to the question of what is life's greatest good that he says nothing negative about at all is friendship. Friendship, he says, transcends justice. It's as close as he comes to saying that love is the highest thing in life. The other Greek words for love are eros, which means desire, and storge, which means natural affection or liking. Both of these are common to men and animals, but friendship is distinctively human. Another Greek word for love, agape, meant simply love in general, generic love in Aristotle's day. And since the Greeks didn't like vague, generic terms, they didn't use it much. When Christianity came into the world, they needed a new term for the new kind of love they had found, the kind of love Jesus taught and lived, the utterly self-giving and non-judgmental and unconditional love that he said his Father was. So the early Christians took this unused word for love, agape, this empty generic term, and invested it with this new, sharp, concrete meaning. And that's the Greek word the New Testament usually uses for love. It used to be translated charity, but today that word has come to connote giving money to the poor. The English word love, on the other hand, in modern English usually connotes a feeling, so that's not a good translation for agape either. You can't command a feeling, but love is the primary commandment, the primary duty in Christian ethics. Aristotle distinguishes three kinds of friendship, based on mutual pleasure, utility, or respect. I could be your friend because you're fun, or because I need you, or because I admire you and want to be like you in character, in virtue, which is the highest form of friendship. He gets these three kinds of friendship from the three kinds of goods. We find things to be good because they give us pleasure, or because they're useful because we need them, or because they're morally good. And I think this is one of the most practical ideas I have ever run across. It means that there are only three good reasons for doing anything, or loving anything: because it's morally good, or because it's a practical necessity, or because it gives you joy. If something is neither moral, nor necessary, nor enjoyable, drop it. I think this idea is far more practical in our day than in Aristotle's, because our lives are so much more complex and confusing today, that a simple, commonsensical idea like this can make a spring cleaning in our lives if we dare to apply it and ask the question, how many of the things we do or have don't come under any one of those three categories? Our lives are so full of stuff and so empty of time, and we would be much freer and happier if we just didn't buy all the stuff we don't need and didn't read all the books or wear the clothes that we really didn't enjoy and spend our energy on a few moral virtues like kindness to our families and justice to our employers and employees and didn't worry about the hundreds of other things that we don't have time for. How refreshing to meet a philosopher who tells us there are only three good reasons for anybody to do anything. Well, this is a mere sample. There are many more worthwhile ideas in this book, and they're all just as understandable and commonsensical as these. I met a man once who worked for a TV studio who spent 2 months every summer living on the streets of New York City with the homeless just to get to know them in a human way, not institutionally, and he gave them books and got them to read them, and he organized discussion groups, and he told me their favorite book was Aristotle's Ethics. I kid you not. Next time, we will look at a medieval Christian philosopher who was much influenced by Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas. His treatise on happiness, a short 10 pages out of his 4,000-page Summa Theologica, borrows many arguments from Aristotle. If you have a chance to read it, see how many of those you can find.
After listening to Lecture 6, a student posed this question to Professor Kraft. Did Aristotle believe in God? Let's listen to the professor's response.
Aristotle did believe in one supreme God, and that God seems to have almost no connection with his ethics. He has a lot of connection with physics. He's the first cause and explanation of all movement in the physical universe. But it's not a religious God, and Aristotle never brings God into his ethics in any way. He does not mention God except in one way. The supreme good in human life is contemplation, and that's the most godlike activity. And he pictures God as contemplating only himself because God's the only perfect thing. So God doesn't even know us, although we can know him in an abstract way. So it's almost two different worlds. It's not a religious ethics. It's not an atheist ethics.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.